Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's the News Roundup, where we check in with area journalists for stories making headlines this week. On Monday, a federal judge in Boston ruled President Trump's directive blocking offshore wind permits is unlawful. It's a move that could be important for the local wind industry, but what will come of the court order is unclear. Plus, we have news about a local nurse's contract and more. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
So this court order on offshore wind is something wind supporters have been waiting for. Remind us briefly what President Trump did that led to this lawsuit.
Sure. This lawsuit stems from action that President Trump took on his very first day in office for this second term back in January. He issued a memo directing that all permits and approvals for wind energy would be halted pending what he called a review of wind leasing and approval practices. Now, that pause on wind applies to offshore wind, which, of course, is very relevant to our area. Mm-hmm. It also applies to onshore wind. And states that have made significant investments in wind object to that. So 17 states plus the District of Columbia sued the Trump administration in May over this order. Then later, an interest group joined the lawsuit. That group is composed of private companies and nonprofit groups that support wind. So that case went to federal district court in Boston.
And this week, the judge said that order was not consistent with the law. So tell us about what she had to say.
Sure. This is Judge Patty B. Saris. She said that Trump's memo was arbitrary because it gave no reasoned explanation for the change to offshore wind practices. And then on top of that, she said federal law requires agencies to decide on permits within a reasonable amount of time. That is under the Administrative Procedure Act. Judge Saris also pointed out that while President Trump's order said the block on wind permits would be subject to this, or they were going to be doing a review rather in the meantime, the government has provided no timeline for when such a review would be completed, and apparently they also provided no timeline in the course of sort of arguing this court case. They didn't give that information, so it seems like without court intervention, that halt on wind energy would go on indefinitely.
Mm. Has the Trump administration responded to that?
Well, in most media outlets, they have not. I asked for comment from the Interior Department and from the specific office that handles offshore wind. That's the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Neither responded. That was also the case in a lot of the other news stories. But Fox News reported that it did receive a statement from the Trump administration about this. In the statement they reported, the White House said that the Biden administration had given offshore wind projects unfair and preferential treatment. The White House said the rest of the energy industry was hindered by burdensome regulations. But that statement that they gave to Fox News really did not directly respond to what's new here in the court case. They did not respond about what the judge's order would mean for blocking federal wind permits. So, and the White House could still appeal as well.
Let's talk about the practical result of this order. What is it going to mean for offshore wind projects that are still in the permitting stage?
That's a good question, and I wanted to explore that with a couple of the people I talked to for this story. At the Conservation Law Foundation, Kate Sending Daly said, this is a little bit of a strange situation because it's like a double negative, right? The Trump administration has been ordered not to issue the permits. But that doesn't really give them a specific order to actually do anything, such as make the permit decisions by a certain date. Mm. I also talked with Mayor John Mitchell from New Bedford. He says the judge's order, as it stands now, does kind of leave open the possibility that if federal agencies are theoretically working on the permits, that they could just move so very slowly that nothing really changes.
So what's next here?
Well, a status conference in the lawsuit has been scheduled for next week. That involves both sides meeting by video with the judge. And Mayor Mitchell says it is possible that at that meeting, the judge could put the Trump administration on a timeline to take action, either yay or nay, on wind permits that are already in process. But he says, yeah, there's really no guarantee that a judge will do something like that.
All right. Moving on to another local story. You gave us an update this week on what's happening with the contract dispute for visiting nurses on Cape Cod. It's been quite a while since the strike with no news. So what's the latest?
They now have another negotiating session scheduled after sort of a hiatus. You are right. It's been a while. It's been almost 2 months since the visiting nurses who work for Cape Cod Healthcare went on a 3-day strike. According to the nurses union, what's been happening there is that they have a federal mediator and the mediator's participation was delayed by the government shutdown. So now they have set this negotiation session. It's for a week from today, December 19th. And again, this is a contract negotiation between the nurses union, which is the Massachusetts Nurses Association, and the employer in this case being Cape Cod Healthcare.
So what are the nurses looking for in the contract?
Well, the visiting nurses are looking for a few things, but it appears that, not unusual, the main sticking point is pay. Mm-hmm. They know that they're not going to get the same rate as nurses who work in hospitals on Cape Cod. It is customary for hospital nurses to earn more. But what the visiting nurses are asking for is to get the same percentage raise that the hospital nurses received over the summer. Both of these groups are registered nurses, and the hospital nurses received 19% over 3 years. The visiting nurses say that's what they need to be able to afford to live on Cape Cod.
And what does Cape Cod Healthcare say about this?
Well, Cape Cod Healthcare has said that its wage offer is already higher, significantly higher, they say, than competitors. And they also say that employee benefits exceed the standard for the industry.
All right. One more story before you go. The state is hosting a meeting Tuesday to collect public comment on an environmental report on the Cape Cod Bridges replacement project. Tell us about that.
Yes, this is a big step, really, in the replacement project for the Bourne and Sagamore Bridges. The state recently submitted a federal document. This is called the Draft Environmental Impact Statement. It's not called an application, but really, in essence, it's a lot like that. All the data and information that they have to provide in this document is used to inform whether they will receive multiple different federal permits. So it's important. It's in a draft form right now. That's how they always do it. The state is going to be taking public comments before finalizing this document. So the Massachusetts Department of Transportation is hosting a meeting. That's at Mass Maritime. Next week, they will be going over the document. They'll be taking public comments. And that meeting is at 6:00 on Tuesday night.
All right. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. As always, thanks, Jeanette.
Thanks, Mindy.
CAI science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes is here to talk about two closely related topics, the state of Cape Cod's water and the plight of wild oysters. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the Association to Preserve Cape Cod released its 7th annual State of the Waters report this week. What kind of information can you find in the report and how is it used?
Well, it's like an annual report card for water quality on the Cape. It looks at coastal embayments, freshwater ponds, and public drinking water supplies. It's based on thousands of water quality samples collected through the year by various monitoring programs, and that raw data is compiled by the Cape Cod Commission's Water Quality Data Portal. Andrew Gottlieb is the executive director of APCC, and he says one of the main goals of the plan is to support public action. And the report includes an action plan that outlines recommended steps that can be taken by individuals and businesses, as well as all levels of government from municipalities on up.
Were there any big surprises?
I wouldn't say there were major changes from recent years, but if you're not familiar with the report, there are some eye-opening numbers. The good news is that 19 out of the Cape's 21 public drinking water supplies were graded excellent. That means they met all state and federal drinking water quality standards. The other two, Buzzards Bay Water District and Wellfleet Municipal Water System, received a grade of good due to the detection of total coliform bacteria. But the report noted in both of those cases, the water suppliers took the measures necessary to address the problem. The other possible grade was poor, and there were no public drinking water supplies in that category this year.
A lot of people are concerned with PFAS seeping into our drinking water. Did the report address that issue?
Yes, that was the one caveat. PFAS was detected in 10 public water supply wells this year, although at levels below the state standard, but the presence of any PFAS could be concerning. Okay.
You reported that APCC will be working to improve freshwater ponds in the coming year. Are those scores getting worse?
No, but 27% of the ponds graded were deemed unacceptable. Ponds and coastal embayments are given a grade of either acceptable or unacceptable. APCC's definition of unacceptable is that immediate restoration is needed, and acceptable means that ongoing protection is required. Gottlieb says historically about one-third of the ponds get a failing grade each year, but it's not always the same ponds every year. And he noted only about 13% of the freshwater ponds on the Cape are currently being monitored, so there are some big holes in the data.
Is there a way for people to look up specific water bodies in the report?
Yes. The full report is online at capecodwaters.org, and there's a tool there that lets you look up the grades and dive into the underlying data by water body. That's a new feature this year.
Okay, we know embayments around the Cape are suffering from nutrient pollution, and towns across the Cape are addressing those issues with sewer infrastructure and septic regulations. Did the report show any improvement there?
No.
No.
Gottlieb says it's too soon to see the results of those efforts. But he's hopeful that coastal embayments will start to improve as more wastewater treatment projects come online. The report looked at monitoring results from 51 embayments, and 48 of those were deemed unacceptable. Two were graded acceptable, and one had insufficient data. So Quissett Harbor and Falmouth and Paynes Creek and Brewster earned the acceptable scores.
And historically, one element of a healthy embayment has been wild oyster reefs, which are now functionally extinct on the Cape. But you had a story this week about efforts to change that.
That's right. The Nature Conservancy is leading a big push to jumpstart wild oyster habitat all along the Massachusetts coastline. And they started with a recent project in Mashpee. I spoke with Dan Goulart, who's the coastal project manager with TNC in Massachusetts. Last month, he oversaw over 130 cubic yards of surf clam shells being deposited into a half acre of Hamblin Pond. And in the spring, they'll seed that base with adult oysters, and the hope is they'll spawn next summer and start to naturally populate the reef.
We know oysters help clean embayment waters. How else do wild oysters help their habitat?
Yeah, so oysters can filter up to 50 gallons of water a day.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and their reefs provided habitat for nursery fish, seaweed, other marine organisms. So they really support the entire food chain. And the reefs can also foster salt marshes and protect coastlines from erosion.
There are almost no wild oyster reefs in our waters today, but they used to be prolific. So how did we get here? Was it over-harvesting, poor water quality, all of the above?
Yeah, all of the above, I'm told. But also, interestingly, a lack of shells. Oyster reefs are made out of oyster shells, and if those shells aren't returned to the reefs after the oysters are harvested, then there's no chance for the reefs to survive.
You said that Hamblin Pond Reef started with surf clam shells. Is that because they're more abundant than the oyster shells?
Yes, and also because they come from deeper waters, so they don't carry the same diseases as oysters and quahogs and other inshore species. Goulart said if they were to start with oyster shells, they would have to store the shells for a year to ensure they're disease-free before putting them in the water. And they're looking to scale up these projects, so that just wouldn't be feasible. He said the shell recycling programs in the state can't provide the volume of shell they're going to need as they move from site-scale projects like the one at Hamblin Pond to larger system-scale projects.
Right. CAI Science and Environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes. Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, an extended deer hunting season on the island. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. There have been some developments in the suit against the Community of Jesus. Ryan Bray from the Cape Cod Chronicle has the details. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Mindy.
So a countersuit and a motion to dismiss, right, first, but remind us what the original suit is all about.
Yeah, so this is all sort of built off of a suit that was filed in a U.S. District Court in Boston in July by Oliver Ortolani, who's a former member of the Community of Jesus. In that suit, you know, there were a lot of allegations made about the community's performing arts center in Brewster and how that was built, as it's alleged in the suit, on the back of unpaid child labor. There were a lot of allegations about trafficking, about the, you know, the extreme, allegedly extreme, you know, work conditions that, you know, children, you know, in some cases as young as nine, were subject to, allegations of treatment and abuse. There's a lot packed into that suit, but that is sort of the basis of, as you said, this countersuit and these motions to dismiss filed by the community and two other nonprofits.
So who's filed the countersuit?
So the countersuit was filed by the Community of Jesus and two other nonprofits, Arts Empowering Life, Inc., and the Performing Arts Center Foundation, Inc. Oliver Ortolani's suit sort of lumps, you know, these three defendants together and makes the allegations against all three entities. But basically, these, as it's alleged, these were the three entities that were directly involved in the construction of that performing arts center.
Yeah. And then what's the basis for the motion to dismiss?
Yeah. So in the motion, which was filed earlier this month, you know, all three of the defendants each filed essentially the same motion. It's basically alleged that, frankly, there isn't enough evidence, you know, provided to support the allegations in the original suit filed in July. A long memorandum that was sort of submitted along with the motions themselves kind of went into more detail, just saying, again, that they sort of make these allegations very vaguely, but they don't, you know, they don't give any direct names. They don't specify in any detail who or what people did what to whom. So there was basically an argument that really the evidence isn't there to sort of support the allegations that were made. It's also claims that, you know, Oliver Ortolani in his suit is basically treating the three defendants as, quote, alter egos of one another, basically saying that, you know, the charges or the allegations apply interchangeably to the three. So there was a lot of dispute there. And then it gets into other, you know, particular points of the suit. You know, there's allegations of violations of the RICO Act. Mm-hmm. It gets into, you know, why those don't hold up. But essentially, it really boils down to the argument that they're making is there just isn't the evidence to support the claims that are being made.
All right. So what's next?
What's next? I think these are all sort of just working their way, you know, through the legal process. Mm-hmm. I mean, Oliver Ortolani's suit, the original one filed in July, is basically seeking rights to a jury trial. They want to take this, put this before a jury. So that's really what's at stake there. Right. In the case of, you know, the motions to dismiss are pretty self-explanatory, but then in the countersuit, the defendants are basically seeking, you know, retribution, or, you know, they want to be recouped for any legal expenses they incur trying to defend that suit if it's found, if that decision works against them ultimately.
All right. Ryan Bray from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ryan, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mindy.
Plans for our new island home back on the annual town meeting ward on Nantucket in May. Josh Balling from the Inquirer and Mirror joins us. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
So the select board this week voted unanimously to put plans before a town meeting once again, right?
One more time, the nursing home proposal will be back. At its meeting last week, the board heard a presentation on options for lowering the cost of building and operating a new skilled nursing facility to replace the existing R Island home on the downtown waterfront, and reviewed the results of a public survey on the project. And as that meeting was going along, board members expressed hesitation then about continuing to push the project on voters who last year rejected it at town meeting. It's got about $130+ million price tag, and it's a pretty sizable expense, and it's the only town municipally owned nursing home left in the state of Massachusetts. And the discussion sort of lean toward moving forward with a closure plan and not bringing it back before the voters again. But the board decided that maybe they didn't make that clear enough, so they decided to put it forward for a week, seek some more input. And a lot of people showed up this Wednesday to express an interest, at the very least, in bringing it back before voters. And most of them, it expressed an interest in keeping the proposal alive and to continue to have a town-owned nursing home on Nantucket. Select Board Chair Don Hill asked those in attendance on this Wednesday to raise their hands if they wanted to give the plans another shot, and almost everyone in the room raised their hand. So it's going to be back at town meeting again in May. This is really an issue that's kind of divided the community a little bit the last couple of years. There have been discussions about building a new nursing home on Nantucket for almost a decade now. Right now we have about a 32 to 35 bed nursing home on East Creek Road down on the waterfront just outside of town. And the plans would be to build a similar size facility. There's a growing aging population on the island, and the supporters say that it's definitely needed, that being 28 to 30 miles out to sea, we need to keep a nursing home on the island for our elderly population, many of whom, the current residents, were born and raised on the island, and certainly they and their families don't want to leave, to have to go off island for care and to have to go back and forth to visit.
Yeah. All right, we'll see what happens in May, right? So also the deer hunt expanded to February.
It is. For both Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, the State Fisheries and Wildlife Board voted unanimously on Wednesday to approve what they call emergency regulations that will extend both Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard's January deer season through February 14th and create another early season hunt next fall. These changes come as Mass Wildlife officials continue to talk about the extreme deer overpopulation on both the islands, which have the highest deer densities in the state. Mass Wildlife estimates that on Nantucket, there are about 100 deer per square mile in some areas of the island. And that's basically 12 to 18 is what the state recommends for a healthy deer population. And they say that that deer, other than being a nuisance to gardens and to potentially sometimes to drivers, is causing extra erosion on some of our dunes, harming agriculture, and also contributing to traffic accidents, and particularly on Nantucket, tick-borne diseases. Nantucket has the highest incident in the country of tick-borne diseases like Lyme, and now babesiosis, and now Lone Star ticks as well are causing the alpha gal, which everybody's talking about. So this deer hunt, the extended hunt, has already been extended into January from the traditional 2 weeks in December at the end of November. It applies to archery and primitive firearms, muzzle-loading firearms, not two shotguns, at least not yet anyway. About 15, 20 years ago, Nantucket had a February hunt for shotguns as well, and it did succeed in harvesting quite a few more deer, but there were a lot of complaints about safety and hunters overrunning the island at one of its quietest times of the year. So The state kind of the compromise is that it'll be archery and primitive firearms, which they say have the potential to not be quite as intrusive as shotgun season would be.
And that is a lot of deer. And the poor deer, I mean, there's so many of them, forget about the plants that are supposedly deer-proof. They'll eat anything, right?
They'll eat anything. Yeah. And many of them are not the healthiest either because the population is so high. They're again, I guess you could say, fortunately, there is so much foliage and so much open space on the island that there is quite a bit of food for the deer, but there are so many. And again, other than hunting, there are no natural predators for deer on the islands, and they just continue to multiply and multiply. Now they're even coming into neighborhoods. I see them I live in a fairly densely populated residential neighborhood, and they're in my front yard. I see them walking down the sidewalk sometimes in the morning. It's crazy.
Yeah. Josh Bolling with the Inquirer Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
All right. Deer hunt, as we mentioned, also expanded on the vineyard. Haley Duffy from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Hi, Haley.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So the extended hunting season, which Josh just talked about, one of the ways of addressing the tick-borne illnesses, at a meeting this week, state officials declared a public health crisis, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did. So they called it a public health crisis, which we had already heard from public officials on the island, public health officials. But that was some pretty big news because it is so prevalently talked about on the island, but there wasn't much movement from the state prior to that this Wednesday when they declared an expansion on the hunting season and came to the island to talk about the crisis.
Yeah, I know we've talked about this before, but the Lone Star ticks are particularly prevalent on the vineyard, right? And so you're seeing a lot of that, a lot of alpha gal, so much so, I think we mentioned this last month, that some of the restaurants actually have on the menu a signature that it's alpha gal safe. If you have alpha gal, you can eat this, right?
Yes. So they have like a specific menu, or they point out menu items that are alpha-gal free or safe, because it's so many people on the island are affected by this. Mm. Yeah. I mean, everyone, multiple people I know have it. When I was talking to hunters this week about hunting and how they can help to alleviate the crisis, a lot of them even have alpha-gal.
Yeah. And so there's a real effort right now to try, I mean, expanding the deer hunting season is just one way, but there's a lot of efforts to try to reduce this crisis of tick-borne illness, right?
Yes. So we've always had a great team of tick experts on the island. It's a small team, but it's a pretty big team, you know, compared to the rest of the country. And last week, a new nonprofit started called Tick Free MV, and they are going to start doing some initiatives that are aiding hunters. For example, we have a use a state program where hunters can donate their venison, and then that goes to some food insecure residents on the island. But on top of that, the nonprofit is going to give $100 for every deer, $100 for every deer male, and then $150 for every female to the hunters to donate.
And this is this possibility that the longer season could become permanent, right, going forward?
Yes. Yes, it looks like there's going to be some public information hearing sessions in 2026 to possibly talk about making the extension permanent. And also, there is the potential that they could allow hunting on Sundays, which Massachusetts is one of two states in the country that doesn't allow hunting on Sundays.
All right. Haley Duffy from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Haley.
Thanks so much.
Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Chairman re-elected as first VP of the National Congress of American Indians. And Callie Remillard from the Enterprise is here with more. Hi, Callie.
Hi, how are you?
All right, so tell us a little bit about this.
Yes. So Brian Whedon, he has been the tribal council chairman for 4 years now, and he was actually the youngest ever tribal chairman elected. He was 28 years old. So now he's been reelected to the first vice president position within the National Congress of American Indians. And he talked to us a little bit about that. They work in that position. He works hands on with the executive committee. They meet monthly virtually, and they host a bunch of in-person sessions. And it was really interesting to hear his perspective on that, because one thing he emphasized was that this position he's in now gives the Mashpee Wampanoag a seat at that table on the national level. Puts them in a positive spotlight. He talked a lot about wanting to continue to put the tribe's best foot forward and represent all of, you know, all the tribes across the nation.
And he served on the Youth Commission with that, right?
He did, yes. So he got involved with that about 10 years ago. It was in 2015, he told us. He later served as the Youth Commission co-vice president for 2 years, and then he ran for this current position that he's in. And he actually spoke about that. There was one quote that really, really touched me, and I want to share it with you.
Yes.
He was saying, "Our youth, a lot of people say our youth are the future of tomorrow, and I'm not one of those people. Our youth are the leaders of today, not tomorrow."
I love that. Yeah.
I love it, too.
Yeah. So what does he hope to accomplish in the second term? I know he's probably got a long agenda, but what are some of the highlights?
Yeah. So he really wants to work across these barriers, you know, from East Coast, West Coast, the middle of the country, and really, advocate for the youth. That's very important to him, especially having been involved in the Youth Council himself. He really sees that the youth are the future of the tribe. And the tribe talks a lot about leaving the earth ready for the next seven generations.
Right.
That's a
that.
Really big part.
Yeah.
I do, too.
Yeah.
And
such
a
great way to think. Yeah.
It is. And I know that's a really big part of what he wants to do. He also wants to establish a task force that reviews the whole organization's bylaws. And they want to permit virtual voting for elections. That is currently not allowed. It can only be in person,
right.
So he really wants to expand that access, which I think is a really great thing.
All right. People are all excited about the news of plans for a Trader Joe's in Mashpee. So what's next in this process?
Oh, yes. It's going to be a process. So next week, Wednesday, December 17th, the Mashpee Planning Board will hold their second public hearing on the topic. And at this hearing, the developer, Mark Bogosian of Longfellow, he is expected to deliver a signed deal with Trader Joe's, the traffic study, which is a big point
of
contention,
yeah.
And they are going to review all of those things and ideally set a next session that will focus exclusively on traffic concerns.
All right. Callie Remmelev from the Enterprise Newspapers. Thank you, Callie.
Thank you.
Coming up, two area librarians are honored and a performance by a Cape Cod musical institution. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. And Wellfleet is considering inspections for short-term rentals. Tyler Jaeger from the Provincetown Independent has that story. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, Mindy. Great to be with you.
So this is a response to the state's stricter safety guidelines for short-term rentals, right? So what prompted that?
Right. So the state has issued this tighter oversight for short-term rentals this year. It was in the state building code. And the housing coordinator of Wellfleet, Ann Schiffenhaus, attributes this change to a couple of real accidents and deaths that have occurred in short-term rentals. So last year, Shannon Hubbard and her one-year-old daughter, Maggie of Brewster, died in a fire at their Airbnb in Clinton, New York. After that incident, and the owner of the rental did not have a working smoke alarm in the fire, it was non-compliant with state fire and building code. And after that incident, State Senator Julian Sear and the State Representative Hadley Luddy introduced legislation to require local fire departments to verify that rentals have working smoke and carbon monoxide detectors. So I think while this is a separate initiative by the state, it was prompted by accidents like in that rental.
Yeah. So property owners in Wellfleet may have to register their short-term rental, pay a registration fee, and then have them inspected annually. Other towns already register and certify, right? So why is Wellfleet a little bit behind here?
So Wellfleet, I think, is behind, first of all, because the housing coordinator in this town was not, the town did not have one until this August. So that was after this grace period where the town needed to make this change. And as you said, Wellfleet and Brewster are the only towns on the Cape that actually really had to sort of rework their rules and do these annual certifications and inspections. So, you know, this is a town that's had a lot of issues with staffing in the last years, I think. This is a housing coordinator position that had not been filled beforehand. So while it's a little unclear exactly what the delay had been, I think it's fair to say that was certainly a factor.
Part of it, yeah. So what happens if you don't register?
Well, I don't think that the state's enforcement rule is not totally clear. They had a grace period of 6 months to register the rentals, but if you don't register on the town's level, there is a proposed $200 per day fine. And this is a major aspect of the seasonal economy in Wellfleet. There are 955 short-term rentals. So not registering your short-term rental could be a serious, you know, financial issue.
Giving you some incentive to make sure you do. All right, yeah. Tyler Jaeger with the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you. Take care.
You bet. CAI's Morning Edition host Sam Houghton talks with State House reporter Katie Lannon for a roundup of state politics.
Moira Healey has been in the news quite a bit, from trying to boost housing efforts to pushing against the Trump administration and the GOP over looming cuts to insurance premiums. Our State House reporter Katie Lannon joins us now to give us the lowdown. Hello, Katie.
Hey there.
Let's start with the accessory dwelling units, or in-law apartments. The governor's big housing bill last year essentially made it easier to build these dwellings in backyards or attached to homes to open up housing production, essentially. Katie, I understand the governor wants to give this program a boost.
Yeah, there have been about 900 applications since this law took effect to build these accessory dwelling units, whether it's over a garage, a tiny home in a backyard. And when you look at the scope of the state's housing crisis, that's not all that much. So the state does want to encourage more people to take this step. And what the governor announced this week is, well, a few things. There's going to be some financing to help low and moderate income homeowners build accessory dwelling units. That'll take effect next year. And the thing that's happening more imminently is next week, the state will open a design challenge where architects and other professionals can submit their plans for ADUs that will give them a chance to win some prize money, but also create a set of prototypes that homeowners who don't know where to begin can just download and dive in with.
Also this week, a new report recommending lawmakers making it easier for cities and towns to raise property taxes. Those taxes, of course, go to funding our police departments, our schools. I can't imagine lawmakers will be quick to allow towns to just raise taxes easier. Does this have a chance of becoming reality? What's the story?
Yeah, it's a tricky ask of state lawmakers, especially as we head into an election year. They probably don't want to be the people you think of when you open your property tax bill if it's much higher in the future. But cities and towns have really been sounding the alarm about a fiscal crisis driven by high inflation and state aid that hasn't kept up, along with that limit on how they're able to raise revenues, most notably property tax increases are capped under a state law known as Proposition 2.5. The Mass Municipal Association says that's too restrictive. It's too hard for them to maintain their levels of services, and they're warning of potential cuts. The other thing the association is asking for, along with more flexibility around this tax cap, is a major boost in state aid. So that might be an easier sell on Beacon Hill. It's often popular to send money home to your district, especially in a campaign season. However, the state is itself going to be facing some strained finances as we continue to see the impact of federal funding cuts.
Okay, that'll be one to watch. Also this week, and this has been front and center in national politics, insurance premiums. State leaders are warning that 400,000 people in Massachusetts could face higher health care costs unless Congress votes to extend the ACA subsidies, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. What are you hearing?
Yeah, and you may remember these subsidies were one of the sticking points in the federal government shutdown. It's still not resolved whether or not they will be extended if Democrats can convince Republicans to take that step. Governor Healey and some leaders from the state's healthcare apparatus have been really calling on them to keep those subsidies in place, warning that there are going to be major price spikes for people who get their insurance through the Massachusetts Health Connector, which is the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Open enrollment is going on now in the Health Connector, and they're saying they've seen more consumers than usual drop their coverage going into the new year, perhaps because they're worried about those price spikes.
Yeah, a lot of people on the Cape, South Coast, and Islands are going to be feeling that. That's our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. Katie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Two Cape Cod Library directors this week received the Rosenthal Community Champion Award from their Barnstable County Human Rights Advisory Commission. CAA's John Basile talked with them about their work and the communities they serve.
The award is given annually to those in the public sector who support human rights, particularly the human rights of immigrants. Antonia Stevens, the director of the Hyannis Public Library, is being recognized for her community collaborations.
Well, one of the things that I feel really strongly about is that even though I'm getting this award, this is not something that I am doing by myself. There is no way that we would be able to do this kind of work without an incredibly dedicated library staff, an extremely supportive board, and a lot of community partners who are willing to help us in all sorts of different projects and initiatives that we're doing to try and help the community. I'm thinking that some of the work that we're doing that's caught people's attention is helping a lot of the immigrant families with ESL and other sort of community connections. I made sure to hire Brazilian librarians when I first got here, when I realized that there was a whole community that we couldn't reach because we didn't have the staff capacity to do that. And I got a grant from the NEH for that. And then right away, you know, the people that I hired knew how to contact the community. So we just immediately started bringing more people in, and it's just blossomed from there. And now one of the ladies that I hired is now my assistant director, Milvia Nogueira. And I think, you know, using working with the Family Table Collaborative to get a community food access fridge in here, really trying to emphasize that everybody is welcome in the space, and working with Duffy to try and help. We let them hook up their mobile unit to our water so that we could provide showers during when they're here. Just really kind of trying to find additional ways that we can help some of the more vulnerable members of our community. I think that's what is being noticed.
And Cindy Cotton, director of the Osterville Village Library, is being recognized for, among other things, her commitment to the Human Library Project.
Well, the Human Library is a program based out of Denmark, and it uses the premise of checking out people instead of books that have had certain experiences. There's 15 pillars of prejudice, such as religion, ethnicity, occupation, and it gives people a chance to talk with somebody they may not normally meet in life and to learn to unjudge them.
And is that a popular feature here at the library?
Yes, it takes a lot of planning. It's usually a one-day event, and we do it once a year. There is a lot of work because it's hard for people to talk about some of these difficult situations, such as racism or anti-Semitism or being an immigrant, and other topics are fully tattooed, or other health challenges, mental health. So it takes a lot of planning and a lot of training to make it happen in a way that people will get a benefit from.
Your library is, it doesn't seem like a library from years ago when I was a kid. That was a building filled with books. This is far from that. What's your library all about?
Well, we're a very inclusive center. We're a cultural and innovation center. You know, we have the 24/7 access to books through the auto lend kiosk that's outside. It holds 240 books and DVDs, so you can come by any time, day or night, with your Clams card to get a book or a movie. We have 7 ways for children to learn, with wonder books that read to them, augmented virtual reality books. We have playaways, iPad things that don't require internet access. We have bilingual books. We have just so many different ways to meet people with how they learn.
How does that come about? How do all these various programs come to be?
Well, with the learning, some of it comes from me because I'm dyslexic, and I always had trouble reading, and you're always looked at as stupid or less than, and so I only do audio books. So it was very important for me to have anybody come in here and not feel judged because they don't read or write the way somebody thinks they should. People should have access to information that meets them where they are and where they can learn at their pace and their way.
And for CAI, I'm John Basile.
And John also has details on a performance by a Cape Cod musical institution.
That's the age-old sound of musicians tuning their instruments. These musicians are gathered on a Monday night at Barnstable High School for a rehearsal of the Cape Cod Concert Band, a long-standing part of the local music community that exists somewhat out of the mainstream of today's music scene. While rock and rap dominate the radio airwaves, there might seem to be little place for a concert band, but this band has maintained its place for decades. Kate Hooley, who plays the flute in the band but is also its president, says the concert band has a long history.
This band actually started back in 1974, and it started associated with the Cape Cod Conservatory at the time. It was called the Conservatory Wind Ensemble. We've had a couple of name changes since then, and in 2014 we went out on our own as an independent musical organization and we became the Cape Cod Concert Band. And you're right, it's an odd thing to do. We had the band. It was like not having the garage, though. We didn't have a venue. We didn't know where we were going to be playing. We didn't know where we would be rehearsing. So we had a few lean years. But now here we are, and we have a great rehearsal space at Barnstable High School and an even better concert venue space at the Barnstable Performing Arts Center, also at the high school.
Conductor Tom Borning is known to many as a music teacher in the Falmouth schools and as a top trumpet player in the region, and since 2021 he has conducted the Cape Cod Concert Band. He says he finds plenty of musicians eager to play in that 52-piece band.
You'd be surprised. I mean, there's a lot of people that grow up having played wind band instruments, and then they look for you know, places to play. And then when I came on as conductor, I definitely reached out to some friends that I knew that, hey, you know, let's think about joining the Cape Cod Concert Band. And so we've grown a little bit in the past few years, and so it's been really wonderful to see the band grow and the musicians. I mean, we have current music educators, we have former music educators, we have nurses, authors, many different people, that scientists, people that love to play an instrument, and professionals, non-professionals alike. So it's a blast.
Is there an audition process? Do you just take everybody who shows interest? How does that work?
There's not really an audition process. We do have a waiting list on a number of instruments at the moment to get in. And usually we'll ask, you know, what have you done? Where have you played before? And, you know, we're not too picky, but at the same time, we just say, we'd like you to be able to play your music by the time the concert rolls around.
And he enjoys teaching.
That's a really important part. And then we need to really make sure we agree trumpet, horn, and trombone, that pickup, da-da, da-da-da-da-da, right? You're gonna hear flute and clarinet in the 2-4 bar go, and the 2-E and you're on up, right? Da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da. Right? It's actually that.
In keeping with holiday tradition, the Cape Cod Concert Band will present one of its non-traditional programs. The centerpiece will be The Lord of the Rings by the contemporary Dutch composer Johan de Meij. This music was inspired by Tolkien's original Ring trilogy and has nothing to do with the music from the more recent films. Here's the concert band rehearsing it. Cape Cod Concert Band presents Magical, Music to Make You Believe, on Saturday, December 13th at 2 p.m. at the Barnstable Performing Arts Center at Barnstable High School, West Main Street in Hyannis. Admission is free, with donations to support the band gladly accepted.
Wow, they sound great. More info on Saturday's performance at CapeCodConcertBand.org. That is the News Roundup for this week. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.